The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance political journalist Marie Leconte.
This week, Marie and I are in the Houses of Parliament to speak to Matt Warman. Now, Matt, for over a decade, was Daily Telegraph technology editor, but in 2015 became the MP for Boston and Skegness. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Joe.
We're going to talk about a report that you've written on democracy and local government in the digital age. But before we do that, this week's news. And there's been a lot of it. There's been a lot of news. Everywhere I look, there's been some more news. I think the main point of discussion, though, we have to start with Brexit because it's the day of the week.
Do we have to, though?
Well, we have to because apparently Jacob Rees-Mogg governs Britain, according to Anna Soubry. That came out this morning. We're going to have a government of national unity, or not. Matt, who's in charge and are we heading for a government of national unity?
No, we're not. And I think the answer is neither Anna Soubry nor Jacob Rees-Mogg is in charge. And actually, to make a serious point, which I know isn't the fashion, what we saw this week is Parliament's in charge. And it's a very close-run thing, but there has been a very clear view expressed on a couple of really important issues. And that's a lot closer than the whips and the government would have liked. And it's because power in a hung Parliament rests primarily with Parliament.
But isn't the issue as well, I guess, that, and I think that's kind of what we saw this week, that I'm not sure there is a deal that could actually satisfy the entirety of Parliament. Because actually, you know, looking at Chequers, obviously the kind of, you know, hard Brexiteers thought it was, you know, the UK would have remained too close to the EU for comfort. But on the other hand, you know, the Labour benches as well, I've spoken to quite a few Labour MPs this week who are like, actually, you know, that's still far too hard a Brexit for us. So, like, do you think, is there actually a deal that, you know, can not even unite, but at least, you know, kind of be palatable to the majority of the MPs?
So that's the challenge, right? And there are three things going on at once. There is a deal on the table, an agreement that is simultaneously too hard for some in the Tory party and too soft for some in the Tory party. And you, with that, also have an opposition who will oppose. Is that the idea that the Labour Party will choose to act in what I would see as the national interest rather than try and vote down the government if it gets the opportunity, is optimistic at best. So what we've got to do is come up with a deal that unites though the Tory party, obviously, that has the backing of our partners in the DUP, and also probably, while we're at it, attracts the support of some Labour MPs as well. But we can't rely on that. I think on the basis that it is being criticised for being both too hard and too soft, then that demonstrates it is in the middle and we need to coalesce around the middle. Can we do that? I think genuinely we can, because there are a whole load of extra factors around what's at stake if we don't. So I think, can it be done? Yes. Is it going to be a painless process for all concerned? No.
Matt, you're MP for Boston and Skegness, which was a strong Leave constituency.
The strongest.
And you yourself, as I understand it, voted to remain. So how does your role stack up locally when it comes to discussing, selling, debating the issues of something like the Chequers deal?
So I described myself during the referendum as a sort of 51-49 kind of Remainer. But I think the most important thing, and a point that I made at the time and since, is that we respect the results of the referendum. I think you can't pretend that people didn't, certainly in my constituency, know what they were voting for. We talked about trade deals. We talked about freedom of movement. We talked about... Even if you talk about it in terms of trade deals, you are talking about the customs union. So I think the idea that voters didn't understand the arguments is just immensely patronising. And I think the more contact you have with voters, which is an MP's job, then the more you realise that you can't stand in Parliament and say people don't know what they're talking about, because by and large, they do. And I think the terms that the referendum campaign was fought on were not significantly less clear than the terms that most elections are fought on. So why do we say we value the results of elections, but we don't value the result of this referendum. I think that argument just is pretty bogus. So we've got to get on with working out what the deal is that Parliament can support that respects the result. And that is, at the risk of sounding like the broken record that lots of politicians have sounded like for the last couple of years, that is about borders and money and laws. And I think we've got to acknowledge that that is the case and get on with it, because getting on with it is the resounding message that comes from all constituencies, because there is no one who says, please, could we talk about Europe a little bit more?
That is so very, very true. Once the deal is struck, what's the next stage? Because it seems to me that a lot of attention in this country has been paid to getting the deal through Parliament and the government agreeing on the position in this country. But of course, they then have to go to Europe and negotiate. So how do you see that playing out?
So I think you're right that the elephant in the room sometimes is it doesn't really matter what Parliament agrees if it's not acceptable to the European Union. I think the fact that we saw Michel Barnier, for instance, welcome this as a significant statement of intent is good news. But whatever the case, all that really underlines is that we do have to be prepared for a no-deal scenario insofar as we possibly can, because we might come to something that Parliament thinks is perfectly fine, albeit inevitably by a very small margin. And then if it does get changed in any significant way, Parliament may express a different view. So we have to be pragmatic and say no deal is an option that we have a duty to be prepared for. But we also have to be realistic about saying there's no point in us going in with a negotiating position that we know the European Union is going to reject out of hand. But I think it's also worth going back to things that have been said earlier in the process. For instance, way back in March, Donald Tusk was talking about a deal which now many people would look at and say, well, actually, that seems a bit more sensible than some of the stuff that we've talked about since. So I think we should reasonably be saying, where could we end up and where has the European Union talked about ending up?
You talked about the role of Parliament. Parliament goes on holiday this week.
Goes on recess,
which was going to lead me to my next question. I think the British public probably doesn't understand the distinction between recess and holiday. They think of it in school terms, and that you just finish and go home and kick back and on the beach for 6 weeks. Particularly as you're in Skegness, so you have a beach.
It is my job to visit the beach, but possibly not kick back on it. I think you are right that politicians as a whole, and this is sort of partly some of the stuff that I wanted to talk about in the report, is that actually politicians as a whole have been very bad at explaining what we think our job is, and we've been very bad at asking the public what they think our job should be. And so as a result, people see what goes on in Westminster. It's very hard to communicate the sort of many and various duties of MPs in general in their constituencies, and some MPs obviously make more of an effort to be really conspicuous whenever they do anything in the constituency. I think we need to, I don't like the phrase, but as a political class, we need to do a lot more at justifying our own existence. I think it would have been a very, very bad look in one of the only jobs in the world where you can vote on whether you have extra days off, so to speak, or not, to have done so, because we struggle to get cut through, so to speak, into the public consciousness with lots of the really important stuff that we do. But the idea of would you like an extra few days holiday, you choose, is something that certainly got cut through, and certainly people didn't feel it was an example of politicians earning the money that they're paid.
I feel like a small detail of that was particularly interesting was the fact that apparently the only reason why actually like your party sort of like went for this as a potential motion was because Labour had apparently agreed to it in private. And then the second it got announced, Labour kind of went, well, how dare you? Like, why would anyone do that? Which is why the motion had to be pulled in the end, and also because some Conservative MPs had actually come out as well and said they'd vote against it. So I'm not entirely sure what happened there, but that was quite interesting.
Well, I think one other sort of side point of that is it's worth pointing out that one of the things that has frustrated people in Parliament about recess for a long time is that it, for instance, aligns with English school holidays. It doesn't align with Scottish school holidays. So you have the SNP quite rightly saying, well, they have a different, if you want to call it, quality of family life, all that sort of stuff, because of parliamentary hours are built around one thing rather than something else. So I think there are a lot of people who would have rightly said, while we don't necessarily want 2 days extra holiday, if you want to call it holiday, we would have wanted the terms to align differently, and people didn't think about that kind of stuff. So there's a whole host of slightly arbitrary factors which we could and should be considering, even if they are never going to be the most important thing, because ultimately it is our job to be here when we're not in our constituencies talking about the stuff that makes the laws and changes the country.
That reminds me, like, I always find it quite mad, the fact that Lib Dem conference falls within recess, but then SNP conference doesn't, when you look at the number of Lib Dem MPs at the moment and the number of SNP MPs.
I mean, cynically, I would say the SNP should just move their conference and clash with the Lib Dems and see who shows up. But I think at the same
clash of the titans
at the same time.
I don't think the Glasgow SEC can same time.
Well, no,
imagine.
I think it probably could. That's the irony.
On one side of the building, you on the other.
But I think sometimes that sort of stuff, as you kind of imply, out there in the public real world, for want of a better phrase, then people wonder, why does Parliament take 3 weeks off for recesses when one of those is for a party that has a very small part of the vote and has a very small number of MPs? Now, I think there are obviously better ways of slicing that, but yet again, it's an example of Parliament looking like it is either out of touch with the public and sometimes in touch with the things that the public do not necessarily hold in the highest esteem.
I do feel a bit weird making that point as the one journalist out of the three of us, but I do kind of partly think that the media has a part to play in this, because they've all, I mean, not all of the media, parts of the media have consistently kind of like called recess, you know, just MPs going on holiday and not doing anything. And I think it's similar to expenses as well, when people talk about expenses, not mentioning the fact that a lot of that money actually goes towards staffing costs, which is, and inevitably Parliament is confusing enough as it is, so I'm not entirely sure why we do end up with kind of, you know, people that should know better, not naming names, fueling that fire, which at the end of the day is not going to help anyone and is probably going to be quite dangerous in the long run.
Yeah, I think there's a huge element of truth in that. At the same time, I do think this is a unique job. I don't think it's acceptable for me to be able to say, well, actually, these couple of weeks I'm on holiday and it doesn't matter if there's some massive issue that arises in the constituency, I'm on holiday. I don't think that's a politically advantageous stance to take, but also I don't think it's the right thing to do. And I think if you take that view, the fact remains that you risk being punished at the ballot box. And this is an extraordinary form of performance-related pay. And I think in that sense, politicians often find themselves slightly facing two ways, having to tread the line of being extraordinarily diligent while also saying, we do, as you've seen with the proxy voting stuff that's been around over the last couple of weeks, then we should find a way of making this a more 21st century working environment. I think on the one hand, the public's very sympathetic to some of those ideas, but then when push comes to shove, often there are some very vocal members in anyone's constituency where people are not. People do expect you to be there, and that's only the right thing.
So now I feel a bit bad for pointing this out, but I was trying to interview someone on the Labour front bench a few days ago, and because they're like, their constituency is around London, so I was like, look, actually, are you going to be around during recess? And they were like, nope, I am off for the entirety of August. And I'm like, fair enough.
Off where? Did they say where they were?
Abroad, very much abroad.
Very abroad, very abroad. Do you look forward to recess?
Yes. I think I very much. There was a conspicuous pause there, wasn't there? I think it's all in the edit. I think there is very much a change is as good as the rest kind of sense. I think it is not unreasonable for MPs to go on holiday, just like anyone else. But I think at the same time, you have to be reasonable about this. And that involves making sure that you do as much. And ultimately, you've got to be your own judge on this sort of stuff, haven't you? But I do think recess is very often, its most valuable aspect is that chance to go back and say, right, this is what we've been doing, this is what we're thinking about doing in the future. How does that key into what people are talking about, in my case, on the beach at Skegness or in the marketplace in Boston or wherever? And having to reconnect with those things is a really valuable part of the job. The interesting thing about asking people, as we have done on the beach at Skegness, is one, they don't want to talk about politics all the time, which is a very sobering lesson.
Not even on the beach.
So I do have this image of you now, so like people having a lovely day at the beach, like eating ice cream, you know, like getting a tan,
wearing a suit and a rosette. Yeah. There I am. Yeah. No, I mean,
sitting next to them, being like, so.
Well, what was really interesting about the 2017 election campaign was Radio 5 Live came with, they had a bus with, that they called the Marginal Mystery Tour, with Emma Barnett doing her show from
a series of
constituencies. And on the one hand, sort of there we were with a little banner over our heads doing a sort of round table discussion, and people on most sides of the political argument. They just want politicians to get on with it. Politics is the nature of having an election is that you outsource a load of decisions for the next period of that parliament. People expect politicians to stand on a manifesto, say we're going to do stuff to the best of our abilities, and just get on with it. And I think that's a really important thing. We never look more out of touch than when we're dancing on the head of a pin, having arcane debates that people really do understand affect their lives, but can't really understand, because often they are right to hold in contempt some of the time the nature of the tone of the discussions that we sometimes have.
You mentioned some MPs really connecting with their constituents and being conspicuous with their constituents. This week we've seen the resignation of a number of different people, John Woodcock, Guto Bebb and Andrew Griffiths. He resigned after sending what was described as 2,000 text messages to two constituents, I think?
Yes, in 3 weeks. In 3 weeks, 2,000 texts in 3 weeks.
Have you ever sent 2,000 texts of any kind to anyone? Because I'm pretty sure I haven't.
Well, I think
a remarkable amount of content.
I think it's important in this sort of stuff to say that MPs do not stand as moral paragons of virtue. We have to allow in a situation like this people to have private lives in the same way that we would expect members of the public to have private lives. So I think, again, it does come back to some important issues around how do we talk about what being in public life means and how do people justify what they've done to their own consciences. And I think you've seen Andrew's resigned, you've seen he's apologised. I think that is clearly a matter for him. You've seen people like John Woodcock have resigned for very different reasons. I think there are public matters and there are private matters, and I think it is reasonable for people to ask for there to be a distinction between those two.
Yeah. Marie, you're from France. So would you like to talk about MPs having affairs?
No, as I said, I actually agree, and I was meant to do some telly on Monday to actually argue that I wasn't entirely sure that story was in the public interest. However, some more stuff came out after that saying that actually Andrew Griffiths was under investigation for potential, I think, over harassment claims as he was appointed minister. So I think that story in a vacuum, I would tend to agree with you because I'm not entirely clear. And also I feel like the consent line was never clearly established in the coverage from the Sunday Mirror, where, you know, because we never got the text from the woman, it was never clear if that was, you know, a relationship that was consensual, that intense but consensual, or non-consensual. But yeah, however, I would say that actually, given that he was already apparently under investigation for something else that was kind of related, then I'm finding it hard to feel sorry for him.
In 2016, 35% of people when surveyed said they thought that sending sexual messages and images to someone else did not constitute cheating, which I thought was a pretty reasonably high bar, I think.
So where's the line? Like, how... I'd be interested to chat to them, be like, seeing, you know, what,
Perhaps we should do this as an experiment. We should send a series of messages from you, Marie, to different people and say, is this sexual yet? And see what
That's
see
how
what
we
happens.
Flirt.
And indeed a series of images as well. Excited yet?
That is definitely not a matter for a politician to decide.
Matt's looking at it in a very worrying way.
Yeah, let the record state he has left the room now.
Only 8% of people admitted sending a sext in that survey. That sounds extremely low to me.
Wouldn't it be an age thing?
Obviously, there's going to be a huge...
Maybe they send, like, sex emails, sex faxes.
Sex
faxes. I'm going to work on that.
I just think... We've seen everyone from FBI agents to MPs send sex. I'm surprised it's only 8%, but maybe it's higher than that. Discussing a different aspect of how technology can be used to interact with MPs.
That is your worst segue.
That's my worst segue of the... It's the last of the series, so, you know, we've got to get really plumb the depths on this. Matt, you're publishing a report next week.
Sorry.
Entitled Who Governs Britain? Democracy and Local Government in the Digital Age. Tell us about that.
So I start from the premise within this report that there is a significant deficit of public confidence that politicians at any level act consistently in the public interest. And what is it that we should be doing to try and tackle some of that? And this is a report that I think the press release describes as wide-ranging. and the reason for that is because I think there are some things where politicians need to be seen to be doing the right thing. They need to be more transparent around what it is that money gets spent on, around who makes decisions, around why they are advertising, for instance, in a certain way to try and garner people's votes. But I think there are also things where the shape of government itself has become slightly out of whack with people's reasonable expectations. So some of that regaining trust in the public interest is around behaving in a different way, and some of it is about structuring things in a different way.
And are you looking at the local level or the national level?
And so we're looking at a bit of both. And so, for instance, one of the things that I talk about is around digital campaigning and how digital campaigning has changed the... we used to sit down on people... sit down, not on people, next to people, on the beach. We used to sit down next to people on the beach at Skegness wearing a rosette in a suit, I know. We used to very much knock on people's doors, talk, sort of try and say, please vote for us rather than someone else. Now, bluntly, if I were to campaign entirely online for the next election, I'm not sure that it would make a huge amount of negative difference, rather than putting bits of paper through people's doors that we know disproportionately end up in the recycling. So I think some of this stuff is about saying online campaigning should explain to you who is targeting you, why they are targeting you, and I think that should be very clear, in the same way that we have an imprint on the bottom of every bit of paper that politicians say that's in, is promoted by X on behalf of Y. One of the things we propose in this report is promoted by X on behalf of Y and targeted at you because we're interested in people who like fishing in the constituency of wherever it is. So massively more transparent around that. I think it's also a bit daft to force Royal Mail to deliver stuff for free during elections, but not to ask the same of Facebook when we know that more people are increasingly using Facebook rather than they are receiving posts that they actually open in that kind of way. So there's some stuff around that, but there's also some stuff around... what is it that makes people feel disconnected from the actions that politicians take? And so there's stuff around who should be taking the controversial decisions on planning, who should hold the pen, so to speak, when it comes to making a decision locally. And crucially, we should have a right to know who that person is. So and this is a sort of very much an early stage proposal, but there is the idea that in the same way that we have a Freedom of Information Act, I think the idea of having a right to know who made that decision and in what capacity they made that decision, and therefore restoring some democratic accountability, I think is a hugely important part of restoring public confidence in politicians.
You were previously technology editor for the Telegraph. Do you think that government has a problem in that it's always at least one, but usually sort of 10 steps behind the latest technology?
So I think there's been a huge shift that if you go back a couple of decades, then the technology at your desk at work would have been way ahead of the technology you had at home. That's now completely flipped on its head. So people expect to be able to do stuff on their phones themselves and understand that that is going to be better than the sort of apparatus that the state can provide. On the other side of that, you've got, therefore, an NHS where I might show up at my GP, get prescribed something, and then show up in A&E whenever and assume that they would know because it's all one national health service. The clue is in the name. And of course they don't, because technically they're different bits of one organisation. A GP is almost certainly a private business. A&E is almost certainly not, or I mean, absolutely certainly not in practice for most people's life. So we haven't made that connection. And that is a hugely difficult thing for the state to do because it's an enormous IT system, but it's massively out of whack with public expectations. Again, how do we try and reconnect with that? Because people think, well, hang on, if I can do my own banking online, but my GP won't email me, what on earth is going on? This must be a system that isn't working in my interest. So I think we've got to do quite a lot around these things. And I don't pretend for a moment that this isn't wide-ranging for a good reason, and that's because there are a whole load of issues to tackle, all of which play into the same kind of thing.
Well, so in that context, then, what do you make of Matt Hancock being appointed as the health secretary? Because he might occasionally do some puzzling things. But if there's one thing he's consistently been quite good at, is actually sort of like using tech and being at the forefront of technological advances and stuff. Like, not quoting the Matt Hancock app, but definitely still talking about the Matt Hancock app. So what did you make of that appointment, actually?
So I think the idea that there will be a massive focus on technology as part of the future of the health service is actually very much consistent with what Jeremy Hunt was talking about. It didn't get the attention perhaps that it deserved, because Jeremy spent a lot of time delivering that huge funding boost that we announced a few weeks ago for the health service. So I think that is a good thing to be building on, and I think Matt is very much the right person to be focusing on that. That said, we shouldn't pretend that technology is a panacea for the health service. An awful lot of what we need to do around technology will help people who are relatively healthy. What we also need to do is focus on the much more expensive, much harder tech that will make people healthier when they're already ill. And that means serious R&D. That means serious international collaboration. And I think what I would ask of Matt Hancock is, yes, absolutely focus on the kind of services that give relatively healthy people better access to their GPs so that we pick some of the low-hanging fruit, but also try and focus on some of that stuff that is about making sure that people live longer, healthier lives, which is what they have consistently been doing for decades, and we need to make sure that continues to go in the right direction.
In terms of democracy and technology and the digital age and all this sort of thing, is there something that is being done in other countries that we could do in this country where we're sort of missing a trick?
So I think the thing that always comes up is something around compulsory voting or digital voting or something like that, which is being done in several countries in various different forms. I think we are quite a long way from being able to have that conversation in anything close to a final way in this country. That's partly because one of the things that we do have is an incredibly secure democratic system when it comes to polling, when it comes to elections, and we have a very good record in places like Tower Hamlets of really cracking down where that goes wrong. What we don't want to do is introduce an inadvertently hackable election system. So I think on things like that and on things like compulsory voting, while they might seem like they're a brilliant solution, I surprise myself, if you like, by actually taking a very small C conservative view on this kind of stuff. I think where technology has a huge role to play, it's in things like allowing public services to be more efficient, allowing public services to be more transparent to people, and also on allowing campaigning to be much more effective. Because ultimately, I have a naive, but I think there is a lot of evidence that this is the case. When people see the decisions that politicians are wrestling with and the things that they take into account when they reach the conclusions that they reach, by and large, they see people who are wrestling with tough decisions and coming to the right conclusions. And I think that is a good thing. The more we can expose people to the workings of that kind of decision-making process, the better.
What do we have to look forward to in politics over the next few weeks and months? We're going to take a couple of weeks off for our own summer recess. And so what do you think we can look forward to?
Please make some very precise.
I think we can look forward to a break from Parliament heating itself up in Westminster. And I think actually, to make a serious point, one of the frustrating things around Westminster politics is that you do really feel the Westminster bubble. You do really feel that disconnect from the public a lot of the time. And I think the more that we can try and do some sensible reconnecting of the sort that I sort of talked about over the next few weeks, the better. I think at the same time, August is not... this August is going to be a crucial period when it comes to the future negotiations with the EU, when it comes to what the next sort of few stages look like. And of course, when you come back in, probably in the autumn, so at some point in the autumn, then we're going to see really important stuff around what does the future of social care look like. So I think you've got that domestic politics continues, and we are running always into local elections coming up in next year, and you'll see that some of the beginnings of campaigning for that. We'll see the European Union stuff continue, hopefully in the right direction. And I would hope that things like the votes we've seen over the last few days do demonstrate that Parliament has a view on the customs union, on that sort of stuff. And I would hope that both sides, just as I would say they should respect the result of the referendum, should also respect the views of Parliament when they've been expressed.
Actually, since you mentioned the local election, so you were in one of the constituencies which, in 2015, UKIP actually did reasonably well. Mm. Obviously, as we all know, UKIP has kind of, like, you know, completely nosedived, but we've seen, and might well be an outlier, but, you know, over the past few days, it's kind of, like, creeping back up in the polls.
6% in the latest Delta Poll survey for The Sun on Sunday.
Ah. And yeah, so, like, I guess, are you worried about UKIP? Is that something that you think that the rise of UKIP, again, especially in a constituency like Boston?
So I think in a constituency like Boston, you can never be complacent about UKIP. I think what has happened in my constituency and in lots of others where UKIP was quite strong is that the councillors themselves have often fragmented into different groups. Some of them have joined the Conservatives. Some of them have become independent. None of them have shown themselves to be delivering in a really successful way for constituents. And I think that's the important thing. Every local election is rightly about bins and public services and roads and all that sort of stuff. And I think we are lucky in a place like Boston that the UKIP group has not done anything like the delivering that some people would have hoped. On the other hand, you're absolutely right. There is a huge constituency across the country that cares passionately about delivering a specific version of Brexit and will go to the polls to prove that point. And so I would say we have to make sure that the Brexit deal that we deliver does respect the money, borders and laws stuff that people care about, and that we explain it in such a way that people are not misled by some of the reporting that, shall we say, is at best frustrating.
Isn't that partly like the issue? So, like, I'm not expecting you to dunk on your colleagues, by the way, just like, I'm going to preface that. You know.
But if you wanted to, it would just be between us and the listener.
But I've seen, you know, some of your colleagues...
There's only one, we're probably all right, aren't we?
Who've resigned from quite junior positions in the Conservative Party over the past few days or weeks, basically saying, you know, well, our seats are at risk because, you know, we come from quite Brexity places and actually we think that's not the sort of... Like, they'll feel betrayed by that deal, our constituents. And what I don't quite get is that in that case, it's like, you know what, actually, you know, Brexit is already a mess for people who kind of, you know, breathe in, like, politics. And so I don't think, you know, we should expect necessarily people to get all, like, to grasp all the kind of, you know, like the granular kind of detail of the Brexit deal we're going to get. And so what I don't get is why those Conservative MPs, like, if they just want to say, you know, I personally disagree with, let's say, Chequers, and that's why I'm resigning, fine. But do you not think there's also a part of actually, you know, if people agree with, let's say, Chequers or another deal, that in that case, just make the case yourself and actually go back to your constituents and say, well, actually, you know, I supported Brexit, or, you know, I now support Brexit and this is a deal I'm happy with. Do you not think it's also partly like the MP's job as well to explain to the constituents?
So essentially the question is it your job as an MP to represent your constituency in Westminster, or Westminster in your constituency, right? And I think you can't simply say, I'm a MP from the party of government, and the government's position is this, and I'm going to go and tell you why it's great on every issue, of course. But what I do think we have to do in situations like this is say, yes, but Chequers is overtly a compromise. It is something that strikes a balance between what is possible, between and what some people might wish, between what is actually deliverable in a reasonable time frame, all that sort of stuff. And I would say it very clearly delivers on control of money, borders and laws. It also uses the opportunity that Brexit provides to then make some decisions around that kind of stuff. Now, people may, and I would say that people may not like those decisions, but the fact of Brexit allows us in the future to change them. Now, some people would say, well, you're not going to change them for a generation, or you're not going to change them for too long. I would say, actually, that is within the gift of Parliament, and this was all about taking back control. So we shouldn't be shy about selling the obvious benefits that Chequers brings, because it is leaving the European Union. On the other hand, we also have to bear in mind that the whole point of being elected is to try and shape government policy. And some people will think that they are better able to do that from inside the proverbial tent, and others will think that the tent is not quite big enough for them. Now, I think that's an individual judgment for individuals. But what I would say is, having been, for instance, to the very first briefing on the deal after the Chequers summit at Downing Street, then I came away thinking that this is a deal that needs explanation, but is much more compelling than people will think if they've only read the headlines in the newspapers. So I think you are right that MPs have a duty to try and make sure that if people are coming to a view, they are doing that on the basis of facts rather than what they have read from partisan sources, whoever they may be.
Producer Nick here, briefly interrupting their conversation to touch base with our friends at Ladbrokes. I'm joined now by Kyle McGrath from Ladbrokes. So, Kyle, Parliament's about to head off on recess and things will get a bit quieter for British politics. But that's not necessarily the case in terms of the EU. We've heard this week murmurings again about a second referendum, and I can see that your prices are falling on another UK-EU referendum before the end of 2019.
Yeah, that's right, Nick, actually. I mean, specifically in the last week, we've seen quite a bit of money on that market. It's moved into to 9-4 now, which is as short as it's been since we've offered the market, actually. I mean, looking back on some of our previous odds, as recently as last month, it was as big as 5-1, and since then we've seen a steady decline as the odds have shortened. It's as short as it's been since then.
And do you get a sense of whether these flare-ups are the consequence of people betting with their political preferences, or more kind of savvy punters seeing that the mood in Parliament is changing? Is this just a reflection of people wanting to back their own horse?
In my opinion, that is what I would put it down to. So, for example, we have a few bettors in certain shops that have backed the selection in from the 5-1 price last month. And they've backed it right the way in from 5-1 to 4-1, right the way through to 9-4. So they don't appear to be particularly price sensitive, which would give us the impression that it's people backing based on political allegiances or opinions sometimes. But of course, you know, there's no way of telling amongst, you know, all the punters. There will be some people that are, you know, are betting more strategically, definitely.
It would be remiss of us not to check in with the Prime Minister. How do Ladbrokes customers feel like she's doing? Is her chance of survival going up?
Marginally. It's slightly stagnated, which I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. Obviously, from the resignations last week, there was a point where her odds were as short as 1-2 to be leaving this year. And we couldn't stop taking bets on that. We're now seeing more shrewd money coming in for probably next year. As a potential leave date. I mean, 2018 is still the marginal favourite at 6-5. It's just obviously nowhere near as short as it was last week. So it's not a glowing endorsement, but it's a steady sign of encouragement, I'd say, for her.
So whether she goes in 2018 or 2019 or even later, your market for the next Conservative leader is still one of the kind of hot markets that you're going to be taking money on. Has the Boris Johnson resignation, and we saw on Wednesday his statement to the Commons, has that given him any boost?
Definitely, yes. I think before the resignation, he was as big as 14-1 for next Tory leader, which was as big as he's been for quite a while. And that's now come into 8-1. He's comfortably the selection that we've taken the most money on over the last week. I'd say followed slightly behind by Jacob Rees-Mogg, who is still the favourite now, 5-1. And the biggest mover in the market has been Steve Baker, actually. So he's come into 40-1 from 66-1 just last week. So there's a definite indication that Brexit supporting voters are siding behind the sort of more prominent Brexiteers in our betting.
Do you think the smart money is going anywhere near Rees-Mogg and Johnson, really? I mean, I see that you've got Gove, Rees-Mogg and Johnson all in the top four. It feels like those kind of totemic Brexiteers are getting a lot of money behind them, but presumably the shrewder punters are going for people like Javid and Hunt, who are sort of just trailing them in your odds.
Definitely. So we saw quite a lot of, I guess, what we would call shrewd money for Javid pre-resignations, so before last Monday. And he's still quite stable in the betting, but there's definitely been a sort of rush of money on those candidates.
And Hunt moving into one of the great offices of state, has that helped his chances?
Yes. So he, as often happens after appointments such as that, he came in, I think, to around about fifth favourite now. But he's now steadied at around about fifth placed. We haven't seen too much money on him since then, actually.
Thanks, Kyle. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.
As part of my now trademark creepy stalking, I've unearthed that you went to Habs Boys School, which is the same school as Matt Lucas, David Baddiel and Sacha Baron Cohen. Do you feel an obligation or responsibility to try and be funny?
I also went to... David Coulthard also went to the same school, and I don't feel...
And Damon Hill, actually.
And,
So it's either comedians...
Actually, embarrassing, I meant Damon Hill when I said David Coulthard, which is a terrible thing to say. So it's that. Also David Lyddington, the Cabinet Office
Jason
Secretary.
Isaacs. Hello to Jason Isaacs.
There are a whole host of people that we could go through. So I neither feel obligation to drive very fast nor to be very funny. This is probably in the interests of all concerned.
And
I also
Twitter bio, exactly, neither
funny nor fast. That's not bad, is it?
Twitter bio in motion. I think I'm also only saying that your previous school was the same school as the McWhirter twins, as well.
Yes. Well, now, and actually, so the McWhirter twins, but for listeners who are not this weird, were...
Most of them will be.
Were behind the Guinness Book of Records.
Yes. And behind a couple of other things as well.
But it did mean that on a couple of school prize days, then one of them came back and gave a whole series of very interesting observations on what was in the Guinness Book of Records and what we might aspire to as adults rather than children.
Was it possible to tell which one was which? I don't even know. Were they identical twins?
Well, I was quite young when I was, and it was.
How would you know Ross from Norris?
It was a while ago.
So I guess Ross was not there later on.
I have no idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Any of the people you mentioned earlier also.
Matt and I are having a lot of fun. Moving on to something else. We talked about technology, and obviously artificial intelligence and robotics is this big area that's going to bring about massive social change, and there's been lots of discussions about how governments might deal with that. With that in mind, and this is a question to both Marie and Matt, what percentage of people do you think would consider having sex with a robot?
I don't know. I feel like it's going to be lower than I think. I'm going to say, probably...
What
like,
did you think in the first place?
I'm going to say, this is a two-part answer. I'm going to say 43%, and then I'm going to say that the rest are cowards.
Matt, what's your... This is actually just looking at this. This is US adults.
Extra cowards.
What do you think, Matt?
I think this is one of those questions where you cannot win with the answer, can you?
Oh, no. On the contrary. I think every answer is a winner.
Yes, I think so. I would probably say that. Let's say one in five would give it a go.
One in four men, 16% overall. 16% would consider, but there's a big gender divide. You will be not surprised to hear. 24% of American men would consider having sex with a robot. Only 9% of women, American women, all I can say is they obviously haven't seen Westworld.
Was this a specific robot, or is it? I think it's probably best not go down this.
They do specify that it's a robot that looks like a human,
right?
It's so weird. Why would? Surely you'd give it a shot. I don't know. I'm going to stop this here.
Most interestingly, when
it's a high bar you've set already.
When you then ask the British people, would it constitute cheating? If your partner had sex with a sex robot, 41% of people said that they would consider it cheating, and a quarter of people said they would not, but it would be awkward. I guess it depends. Depends whether you caught them.
Is it a single use robot, or do you?
That was not specified in the question. I'm beginning to think this was an avenue we perhaps shouldn't have
more of a cul-de-sac than an avenue
gone down. With that, we'd like to say a big thank you to Matt, not just for discussing the McWhirters in detail, because you've got to have dedication in these things, not just for letting us into his office, but also for being kind enough to speak to us today. The report is Who Governs Britain: Democracy and Local Government in the Digital Age. It's available on.
It's available online, and there are hard copies available as well.
Okay, brilliant. We're all off for the next couple of weeks, enjoying our summer recess. Where are you off to, Marie?
I'm literally not going anywhere. I'm just going to work throughout the summer.
Woo! Yeah, me too.
Enjoy your holidays.
No, I think you should all come work hard in Skegness.
You did say there was a beach.
There is a beach.
What do you mean you did say that? Everyone knows that. That's all anyone knows about Skegness.
Foreign!
There are donkeys as well. I don't know if that's a...
I do quite like donkeys
as well.
Okay,
good.
Bracing fresh air, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Sadly, no time for our interview with Elon Musk, but we're just going to leave you with a quick look at the video of Boris Johnson's leaving speech. It's in Jeffrey House seat, you know. Thanks, see you in a couple of weeks.
Well, that could have been worse.
Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podotpods.com.